Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes.
We wanted to draw your attention to our crowdfunding page on Patreon. If you've been enjoying Always Take Notes, please do consider supporting us there. It helps us to keep the podcast going.
If you support us on Patreon, you can get a great selection of rewards, including a shout out on the show and a selection of successful magazine pitches. Thanks again for supporting Always Take Notes. Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, Rachel and myself spoke with the literary agent and novelist Abigail Bergstrom.
We spoke to Abigail about her experience working in publishing and her transition into agenting, about setting up her own business with Bergstrom Studio, and about writing novels of her own.
It's a great episode, and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, Abigail, to Always Take Notes. It's great to have you on the show. Could we start with your early life? Where did your love of reading come from? What sort of age were you when you first started getting into books?
Gosh, yeah, books were... they've always been a part of my life, really. I always remember being read to as a child, and we always had books at home. My mum always says I'm the youngest of three, so I've got two older sisters. And so my mum always says that, you know, I was so desperate to sort of like articulate myself and be able to enter the conversation from such a young age. And I think, yeah, reading was really a way to improve on my vocabulary and express myself and find my voice in a kind of busy family household. So I've always loved books.
And I was reading in the Sunday Times piece you sent us where you were talking about burnout, but in you're saying that, you know, you came into publishing, you grew up in Newport, your parents were police officers, and like this is, you came into an environment which was very different to that, and you sort of had to fight your way through it. I mean, we wanted to come through the kind of specifics of how you built your career in due course, but has that been a big factor, did feeling an outsider coming in at the start of your career?
Yeah, I mean, I'm conscious to always sort of caveat that feeling in a sense, because I am a white woman, I am able-bodied, I, you know, university educated, there's so much kind of privilege and opportunity that I've had in my life, and I can kind of only use the lens of my experience to have a small understanding of what it's like for other people in publishing as well, from kind of all different types of intersections and backgrounds. But certainly for me, it was very, I don't know, the fact that I was Welsh, the fact that I was working class, it was referred to and talked about, and it was a point of difference that was acknowledged in my career from the get-go and from very, very early on. And I think as well, it was something that I experienced at university. You know, I went to King's College London, I was in seminars with, you know, the vast majority of people who'd been privately educated, which as we know is 7% of the population in the UK. And I felt like a fish out of water, like I very much wasn't used to or able to, I think I was spoon-fed at comprehensive. You're spoon-fed to get the results you need to get you to that next step, but the level of education and learning is very different, and I felt so behind. I remember early weeks at university calling my parents and saying like, yo, we've made a mistake. I'm clever in the context of like our small village in Wales. I'm not clever. Like I'm out of my depth. I'm drowning. I don't know what I'm doing here. And I had so many gaps in my knowledge, you know, around sort of Latin, classical education. And I really struggled at the beginning. I struggled to catch up. And I did, you know, I did get there and I graduated with a great result, but it took a lot more work to catch up. And I guess that's sort of how I felt then again when I entered the publishing industry, just this sense of being slightly behind and not having the context that a lot of people had.
I read as well that before you went into publishing, you were considering doing a law conversion and you'd done lots of internships and so forth. How did that career path sort of develop in tandem, and what was the sort of sliding doors moment where you decided to go for publishing?
Yeah, I was internship mad. It was kind of this idea that the more experience you had, the more internships that you had under your belt, the more employable that you would be. And so I effectively had two working CVs, and one of those was much more creative with kind of PR background, journalism. I did an internship at like the Telegraph, and then the other one was strictly law firms and barrister chambers and all law related. So I was really treading down both those paths for a really long time, and I was so close to doing a law degree. when I'd actually handed in my application, my parents thought that I'd still applied for law, and I haven't actually, I changed. I've applied for English now. And they were like, what? You didn't tell us that. So it was always so, so close. It was hanging by a thread. And I think the thing that pushed me in the end, I went to Hong Kong, and I went and lived out there for about 6 months. And whilst I was there, I did an internship at an international law firm. And I think being in that very, very corporate environment, I just didn't fit. I didn't feel at home. I didn't feel like I could express myself. I felt like I had to kind of tone myself down, and it just didn't feel right. And my stepdad said to me, you know, it's the environment that you're working in. It should feel right. It should feel good. It should be inspiring. And if you don't feel like that in these environments, then maybe it's just not the right place for you. And so, yeah, I came back, and I came back from Hong Kong. I was due to start my law conversion that sort of autumn, I guess. Yeah, that September when I got back, I was due to start it. And my parents had paid the deposit on it, so I felt terrible about that. But I just did a complete 180 and was like, no, it's not the right thing. And then tried to pursue a career in publishing.
We saw that there was a particular moment when you tried on various suits and other bits of corporate apparel and decided you didn't like any of them. Was that a particular hinge point?
So that was going to Hong Kong. My parents took me shopping to buy a suit, something smart to wear. I was trying all these suits on, and we were going from shop to shop to shop to shop. And my stepdad was kind of like exhausted and running out of patience, I think, God bless him. And I think I probably tried on what was like the 11th suit of that day. And he was just like, look, love, maybe it's not the suits. Maybe it's how you feel in a suit. And I think he could see that I was a creative person. I like to express myself in certain ways. And I think he could see that, you know, I would have to temper that in a sense to go into criminal law, and certainly as well the bar. You know, as we know, there's a whole costume and formality element around that. And I think he could see that it wasn't a good fit for me. And that was a light bulb moment. It feels so kind of futile and silly, right? Like the clothes that you put on your body. But it was true. Like I didn't feel myself in this suit. And I am somebody, I love fashion, I love clothes, I love self-expression. And yeah, that was a bit of a light bulb moment of like, maybe it's not for me.
So once you decided on publishing, how did you make your first steps and end up at Simon & Schuster in 2011?
Oh, it was really difficult. It was really, really hard. I think you knock on so many doors and you get rejected, rejected, rejected. And I had a couple of experiences of getting down to the final two for editorial assistant or publicity assistant roles and not quite making it. And I was sort of sofa hopping because I just got back from Hong Kong. I didn't have anywhere to live in London. And my option was kind of get a job in London or move back to Wales. And that for me was just, that was going back, you know, in all manners of the word. And so I really, really was desperately wanting to stay. So I kind of could see that everybody in publishing was obsessed with digital. You know, ebooks were reasonably new then. They were on the rise. Everybody was scared they were going to cannibalize the industry. And there was a lot of confusion. So I got a job at a digital advertising agency to pay my bills and kind of get myself back to London in a formal way. And that actually was the thing that set me apart and got me my job as a publicity assistant at Simon & Schuster. I think kind of having that knowledge of digital and being able to talk that language a bit and show that I had some experience in it. The publishing industry was looking to hire younger people who could come in with that skill set. And I was definitely part of that generation of people that started coming in and commissioning off the back of social media. It takes a long time to build contacts as an editor in publishing. Agents send you things. They're the ones that, you know, read the slush piles and search for new talent, and they bring the writers to agents. And so there's so many editors above you. There's so many editors more experienced than you that have set out a list, a taste, have published things very successfully. To get agents to start sending to you is incredibly hard. But I think my generation of editors were able to shortcut, because actually for the first time ever, social media was telling publishers what people were interested in, what the trends were, what they wanted to read. And also people could kind of stand on their own voice box. And there were, you know, there were a lot of people that I don't think publishers were interested in commissioning or would have been commissioned, certainly in the very trad world of publishing. But suddenly there were these audiences there saying, no, we want to hear from this person. We're really interested in this subject. And that enabled me to approach authors and writers directly in a different way and not have to sit around and spend 2 years building relationships to get people to start sending me stuff.
And you went from this first job to being a commissioning editor in 3 years. How did you kind of move up the ranks in that relatively condensed period of time?
Yeah, so I started at Simon & Schuster as a publicity assistant. I was there for 6 months and then an editorial assistant in-house, a role in-house came up. So I applied for that. And I always say to people, just get your foot in the door, get your foot in the door, because those editorial roles are the ones that everybody wants. And if you're in and people know you, you're going to be the first to find out about them and you're increasing your chances. So that's effectively what I did. 6 months later, I was in that editorial role. And I think 6 months later, I commissioned my first book, which was Everyday Sexism by Laura Bates, which was, you know, a very successful book. She's incredible. I still work with Laura today. And that was kind of shortlisted as one of Waterstone's Book of the Year. And that then really enabled me to start commissioning, because I'd done so and I'd published a book that was successful. And then I was given a lot more free rein and trust. But that was unheard of. You know, it could take 2 years, 3 years before you'd ever start commissioning. Whereas for me, it happened relatively quickly because as I just explained, I was able to approach and go, look, this thing is happening and there's all these people gathered and there's this movement and we should approach this person. And nobody else in the team that I was working with at that time really, really got it or got what Laura was doing. And so they let me kind of do my little project. And I was lucky. They supported me. They let me run with it. And I know in a lot of other publishing houses, that wouldn't have been the case. It would have been commissioned by a senior editor and I would have got to kind of shadow on the project. So yeah, I'm really grateful to Simon & Schuster for that.
We ask every guest about money. And in those early years, bearing in mind, you know, you said you didn't have family in London that you could kind of live with and fall back on. How did you make it work? And, you know, salaries when you're an editor assistant at publishing houses are not brilliant. Was it enough to live on?
No, it wasn't enough to live on. I mean, I lived in this tiny ex-local authority flat. We had, there was a tiny kitchen and there was like a corridor and two rooms, which were mine and my friend's bedroom. And we had this little foldable chair and tables and we used to put them in the corridor. And then I would just reach into my bedroom and grab my lamp and pull the lamp into the corridor and turn it on, because there weren't any lights in this corridor. And that would be our little dining room. I mean, it was cockroach infested. It was horrible, but it was all we could afford. And I actually have, my friend was working at an advertising agency at the time, but again, very junior in an art buying role. And I remember her boss used to buy us food. She would buy food and give it to her to take home because she knew like that we were struggling and we didn't have a lot of money. So it was really hard, but the context at the time was, we've got these jobs in these industries that we want to be in and we've got this shot and this opportunity and we're in London and we're paying for our own flat. And, you know, at the same time, those are some of the most incredible years of my life. And I had a lot of fun. Like I always say, London's a great place to be broke as well, you know, because there's so much free art and so many free events, and you can access culture there in a way that just wasn't available to me and my friend in Wales. That wasn't there. That wasn't on our doorstep. So, but it was hard. Yeah, for sure.
Why do you think the pay is so bad? I mean, you know, it's obviously, it's a kind of character forming war story now that you can tell, but clearly that, you know, it was an extremely difficult experience. I mean, is it just because there's this latent assumption that everyone will have, you know, that everyone's middle class and that everyone has relatives they can stay with and things like that? Or, you know, why is that allowed to happen?
I mean, it's, yes, I suppose there must be some of that that's ingrained in the industry of sort of having family money or having someone to stay with, or I don't know, even having a family friend who lives in London that one could stay with. I think there's some of that assumption. And I do think publishing has, and has been for a long time now, really, really looking at that, looking at itself. I mean, it's, you will be criticized and it's frowned upon. I don't think anybody would have the gall or audacity to put out an unpaid internship in this day and age, because it just, you're completely cutting out so many amazing people. But you know, people always say there's no money in publishing, and there is money in publishing, but it's often sort of more towards the top, and you do have to just work hard and get your head down to get there. And the proof has to be in your pudding. It's like, you've got to make the publishers so much money before they're kind of willing to pay you the level of salary that you would want or expect. But at the same time, it's not advertising, right? It's not advertising. Those are two completely different economies in terms of industries. And the margins around books are smaller, and the amount of sales around books, and the fact that you can buy them in different formats, and the way that retailers now are pushing so much discounts. It's difficult. And there's also this kind of avalanche of content, this avalanche of books, so many books. And actually, there's a very few books that keep the lights on and pay the rent and have that international breakout success. And a lot of the rest is just throwing stuff at the wall and to see what sticks. And that's, I think, the gluttony of content and books is publishers' biggest problem. They're all doing too many and not publishing them well enough.
We interviewed Alexandra Pringle a few years ago, and she said the same thing in terms of Harry Potter just lifting the entire Bloomsbury sort of portfolio, but also, you know, changing the company's fortunes entirely. Returning a bit to the chronology of your career, you became a literary agent in 2016. How did that come about, and why did you decide you wanted to be on a slightly different side of the publishing spectrum?
That came about, I was publishing a lot of kind of like digital first writers, and this digital first kind of talent management company, I published one of their authors, and the owner of that company, the CEO, kind of took me for lunch and just said, look, there's so much interest in our talent, in our writers and the people we're signing to write books. And we're getting all these deals from publishers and we're getting offered all this money, but we don't know the terms that we should be asking for. And we don't want to work like Curtis Brown or wanting to work with us. Various other agents are kind of, you know, they were having conversations, but they wanted to keep it in house. You know, they wanted to keep that money in house. So they were looking for somebody to go in and work for them. And I was like, oh, right. And we had this whole conversation, this whole lunch. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll have a think. Like, I'll see if I can think of anyone. Like, I'll send you some contacts and da, 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 da. And it was only when I left the lunch and got back to my desk that it sort of dawned on me where I was like, oh, I think he was seeing if you wanted the job. I think he was trying to sense check if it was something that you would want to do. And so I emailed him and was like, I think I completely misread the lunch. And, you know, were you implying, you know, if I would want to do it? And he was like, well, yeah, would you? And I was like, yeah, okay, let me think about it. And for me, it was just an opportunity to, you know, publishing can feel quite backwards. It can feel quite old fashioned. It can feel quite stiff. And the idea of going into like an entrepreneurial, young, modern business that was looking, it was future facing, you know, it had its foot in the future. It was on the cusp of all of these different social platforms, the way that digital media was going to change the way that people publicized and promoted their books, even the way that people got published. So it felt exciting. And also after a while, for me, being in-house at a publisher, it felt a bit like a production line. You commission a book, you brief the jacket, you pitch it to sales, you edit it, you wait for it to come in. I started to lose that fire in my belly and that excitement when the book came in and you held it in your hands. And I just wanted to do something different. And agenting suits me so much more, you know, no like long internal meetings, no politics. You're a lone wolf, and that either suits you or it doesn't, but it definitely suits me.
Could you tell us about this development in 2017 when you were headhunted to set up and run Gleam Futures? What was Gleam all about? And was this a kind of extension of this focus on writers who were coming through social media and things like that?
Yeah, it absolutely was. So Dom headhunted me to go over and, you know, work with their talent and kind of work with all of the existing interests that they had and the publishers that were coming to them. And so I went over and did that. And, you know, I remember my boss saying to me, in fact, I remember the CEO of Simon & Schuster, Ian Chapman, who's an amazing man, say, this is a like bold move, and this is either going to be the best move of your career and it's going to put you on the map, or it's going to be like the worst move you've ever made. And because at that time I was having a lot of success with the books that I was publishing at SNS, I was curating a list, you know, I was starting to build those relationships. Things were going really, really well. And I think the concern from people around me was, you're just going to go somewhere and you're going to be the sort of rights person, really. You know, publishers are going to come in and you're just going to be selling them this IP, and it's not creative and it's not fulfilling. Whereas I felt like there was an opportunity to set up a literary arm that specialized in digital first writers, where we could say to authors, look, I've got the publishing experience, I've worked in-house for 5 years, you know, I've worked my way up to editorial director, but what we've also got here is a company who is in meetings with, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter every day, is on the cusp of algorithm shifts, how they're changing, you know, we understand digital strategy, and we can offer authors that side as well. So I went in, I did the job that I was asked to for a year. And then after that, I kind of pitched this idea for this like digital first sort of literary agency that specialized in a way that I didn't see happening anywhere else. And it was a real close call. I remember it really clearly. I had the CEO, the COO, and the kind of managing director in the room with me. And I'd been told to go away and write this business plan. And I had, you know, I literally gone home, Googled, how do you write a business plan? And I pulled it all together and I'd gone into this meeting and I pitched it in. And the managing director was really keen on the idea and she was really excited by it and really enthusiastic. But the COO was really hesitant, really reluctant, and thought that if we started representing writers that we didn't manage, that it was going to cause problems and disgruntled talent, and had various other kind of reservations. And I was just watching Dom, you know, listen to him and take in all that information and listen to her to take all in that information. And it was, you know, these two advisors that he trusted, and it could have gone either way. And he just went, okay, right, do it. Go and make it happen. Like, start. And I was like, okay. And so it was just nuts. I just went and made it happen. But it could have so easily been a no. I really, that was a real kind of turning point for me. And so I set up this agency, I launched it, and we had multiple kind of record-breaking, best-selling books. And yeah, I think we really set ourselves apart in the industry as offering writers something that they were really needing and wanting at the time that wasn't being offered by other literary agencies then.
Can you unpack a little bit what a digital-first strategy actually looks like and how that differs from a sort of traditional offering in publishing?
I think it's about working with writers who are, or at then, I mean, gosh, how many years ago was this now? 8 years ago, was it? But working with authors who are reverberating on lots of different platforms. So, i.e. this idea that you can be an expert on, you know, you can be an incredible neuroscientist and you can have a theory and idea and you can write this book and you can put it out into the world. But ultimately, there are neuroscientists out there that have a incredible theory and idea, and they've written a great book, but they also have a really brilliant podcast, and they also have an online column here, and they also have a social media following of 100,000 people that can be grown and tethered and developed. And which one of those is going to get the book deal? So to just have an idea to get that cut through, and I'm not saying that you need a social media following to have a book, because I'm the first person to say that isn't the case. A social media following does not make a book, and it sure as hell does not make for a successful one. It's hard, regardless of that. But the point is, there's so much noise. Again, this comes back to the glutton, this comes back to the avalanche of content. There's so much noise, there's so many voices, it's so loud. How are you gonna be the one to cut through? And you being the one to cut through is operating on these little, on the lots of these different platforms. And you need to be able to kind of harness those. You need to have a strategy for those and how they're all going to work together to sow the seeds and develop a strategy that's going to be saying the same thing to get your message through and to get people to buy your books and engage with you as a writer. And that can work, if done well, really successfully.
Were these writers that, you know, were being picked up directly by publishers because they had a lot of prominence on social media and so forth, were they generally writing the books themselves? Or would this be a case of pairing someone with a big platform with a ghost and then going in that direction?
On the Gleam titles list that I set up, which was signing writers with that digital first element, absolutely not. I mean, you wouldn't be signed to the Gleam titles list unless you were writing your own book. The way that I kind of marketed and pitched and sold it was, these are incredible writers first and foremost, and you're going to receive this proposal and you should want to publish this book purely and solely off the back of the writing itself. And the fact that there's however many followers, or the fact that they've got a community around a podcast, or the fact that they've got a newsletter that has X amount of subscribers, that's a good start for a marketing campaign. It's not the marketing campaign, it's a good jumping off point. But at the time, there were a lot of agents who were doing deals solely off numbers. They were just sending, you know, follower numbers and an outline and doing deals off the back of that, for sure. And Gleam certainly represented talent whereby, yeah, they were ghosts and listed. I mean, I think these people, you know, some of the people that Gleam represented were social media influencers. And that was the kind of differentiation between Gleam and Gleam titles. Gleam titles was you're a writer and you might have these other things. And let's be real, you know, some of the people that I signed, they weren't huge. They might have had a following of 10,000 people, and they were talking about something very specific, and they were having a conversation with the community. And it's a really good signal. Gives a really good indication as to kind of the waves of the zeitgeist. Like, what's the next big conversation? What's the next kind of socio-political thing that we need to shift and face and excavate? So that was more the thinking and the drive there, for sure.
Was there an emphasis on turning around these titles a bit faster than normal in terms of hitting that zeitgeist and capitalizing on subjects that people were interested in?
Sometimes, but that usually came from the author. So, you know, there might have been a case where an author was changing a law, for example, was one author I had, and she changed a law. I mean, she's an incredible person, Gina Martin. And, you know, the book very much wanted to come out. She wanted the book to come out in tandem to raise awareness. And so the deadline for that would have been tighter than it otherwise would have been, because we wanted it to coincide. They definitely are. I mean, the way that publishers can turn around books now, especially like reality TV, and I know there've been like Love Island and those sort of kind of people that have put books out sort of the day they leave the island or whatever. And you're like, well, how's that happened? The rate at which publishers can turn things around and move is incredible. But it depends on the project. I mean, if you're launching like a debut novel, you don't want to rush something like that out. You need long tail. There's a 9-month selling cycle. You need to be putting proofs out. You need to be visiting bookshops, having a narrative and a dialogue. So some things you can turn around quicker than others, and others it would just impact on the book really, really badly too. So it depends. It depends on the project. But yeah, for sure, I think digital, like viral conversations, digital trends, the zeitgeist has all pushed publishers to turn around books and publish quicker than they ever have before. That is undoubtedly a fact.
Hello, it's Artemis, the producer of Always Take Notes. I hope you're enjoying Simon and Rachel's conversation with the literary agent and novelist Abigail Bergstrom. It's time for the next instalment of our segment, where we share bonus material that we've recorded with previous guests of the show. So this week we're going to hear from the novelist and short story writer Tessa Hadley, and she's going to tell you about failure in her writing career.
I failed over and over in my writing career, and I guess the lesson you learn each time from those mistakes has to be different, because it's often particular. You're addressing a particular short story that you can't make it work, and you may be looking at an issue of voice or tone or bittiness, but you are in all your struggles to put it right, and perhaps your eventual failure and throwing it away into the trash bin. You're rehearsing what's required for a good and economical short story that comes off the page and is alive.
That was Tessa Hadley. And if you were interested in what Tessa had to say, you can listen to our full interview with her via our website, which is www.alwaystakenotes.com. But for now, back to Simon and Rachel's conversation with Abigail Bergstrom.
You were nominated for Literary Agent of the Year in 2020. And a kind of running theme we have on the podcast is the impact of prizes and awards and nominations on people's careers. And did that make a big difference for you, or was it just a nice thing to have?
I don't think so. It's a nice thing to have in your bio, isn't it? And I think when you're trying to attract new clients, but also a lot of the time you will receive a submission from an author that you want to represent, and you'll get in touch with them. But of course, the proposal's incredible, the novel's amazing. And so they've got three other agents that have come back to them. And then there's this kind of like, you know, beauty contest of who's going to get them, and, you know, who has the right chemistry with them, and who's going to impress them and be the agent they want to go with. So I think for things like that, it's helpful. Like, I always list in my bio, like, awards that my authors have won or been shortlisted for, or, you know, things like that. But nah, not really. I don't think it's had a, you know, huge impact on my career or the direction that it went in. It was just a nice thing to be nominated for.
There was a quite public argument in 2021 between two of the authors in Gleam's stable, where one accused the other of copying them and obviously the other denied it. What was your perspective on it all as someone sort of working with both of them?
Do you know what? That was a really, really complicated time and a really, really complicated thing that went on. And it's just, I represented both of them, so it's not something that I'm willing to discuss or take sides on in this forum.
That seems fair enough. What was the kind of broader response from, as you say, the sort of slightly stiff, rather traditional publishing industry to what you were doing and the success that you were meeting at this time? Was it a sense that the big houses wanted to get on board with this, or was there any kind of snobbery towards these sort of books and things like that? What were the vibrations that you were getting back more broadly?
I mean, there was very much, specifically as it all started off with like the YouTuber phenomenon, right? And YouTubers and that kind of thing. And that was a huge part of what Gleam did. I mean, they represented Zoella, Alfie Days, and those kind of OG YouTubers. So there was a huge snobbery, but there was also this idea that, oh, it's a flash in the pan and it'll go away. And you know, there was extent to which I agreed with that and extent to which I didn't. And the first thing that made me interested in the YouTuber element was the fact that you've got like hundreds of kids queuing around Waterstones trying to get in.
We have heard about the Waterstones queue for Alfie's book. It has emerged previously on the podcast, so this is a point of discussion.
And you know, kids like going into it. I mean, it wasn't just Alfie. There was a whole like kind of thing happening where they were all putting books out and all of their books were hitting the bestseller list, and there was like this huge, you know, some books are based off, you buy the book because you love the person, right? Or you're obsessed with their music, or you're obsessed with their whatever, or so that was where it began. And I thought that there was something interesting there. I thought that there was something happening there. And then the publishing industry kind of felt like anything, something does well, publishers publish into it, and then it saturates the market. Everyone gets bored of it, and then that genre kind of falls by the wayside. And we've seen it happen so many times with so many different genres. But what I could see that was happening at the time, and what I believed was going to happen, is that actually you're going to have all manner of people using social media to put out and talk about something, be it a neuroscientist. I use that example again because I signed a neuroscientist recently, Nicole Vignola, and her book Penguin are publishing next year, and it's really exciting. But she's got a solid social media platform where she's kind of sharing these, helping people understand how their brain works, and in understanding that, they can learn to form better habits. They can learn to kind of like change the way that they live, basically, and improve their lifestyle by understanding these things in the exact same way that we've seen therapist books flood the market. And now we're all kind of like using words like triggered and trauma. You know, we've learned this from experts in the industry, and then it's sort of bubbled into the mainstream. And I think the same thing's going to happen with neuroscience. But that aside, whether it be classic cars, whether it be changing the law, whether it be feminism, like people were going to be putting their ideas out in the digital landscape, and books were still going to be coming off the back of that, no matter what you were doing, no matter what you were publishing. It wasn't this like, oh, the digital things happen now, like let's go back to, you know, proper writers, quote unquote, and real books, quote unquote. And I could see so many talented writers out there doing that. I mean, Laura Bates being one, who from the very beginning of my career was always using these social platforms in interesting ways. Gina Martin, Emma Gannon, Scarlett Curtis. And so for me, I didn't see, you know, there's a lot of kind of press releases running the bookseller, of a lot of agents kind of like, it's over and slagging it off. And it was always kind of me at the bottom, like pushing back, like, no, like there's still something exciting here. There's still something happening. But I definitely remember going into Dom's office and saying like, look, it's over. This moment that we had, or that your business had, has been amazing. And it's been incredibly fruitful for you, but it's coming to an end, and it's time to do something different. And if publishing is something that you're serious about and that you want to do long tail, then this is what I propose. Like, we set up an agency and we start signing writers and we go in this direction. And that was all kind of back to what we talked about earlier. But yeah, of course, there's always snobbery in publishing. Always. Even if you're like Marianne Keyes and you've sold, you know, millions of copies across the world. Of course, you, then you've got the, you know, the literary realms and areas that, you know, have very specific ideas about what book should be and what a writer is. And I've always published across the spectrum. You know, I've published literary, I've published commercial, I've done cookbooks, I've done kids' books, I've done, you know, literary debuts, I've done it all. And I don't, for me, it's not that clear cut. I don't know, I don't have snobbery and wouldn't want to work in certain areas. I kind of feel fed by it all.
Yeah, that snobbery of genre is another theme that's come up quite regularly on the podcast. Obviously, this period was really exciting and challenging and interesting for you, but it's also very tiring. And you sent us a piece that you'd written about burnout before the interview. Could you tell us a little bit about that period and then also why you wanted to share your experience with others?
I mean, look, that was kind of around the time that I'd been nominated for Literary Agent of the Year at the British Book Awards. I'd had like multiple bestsellers. I was signing loads of authors. Like, the business was thriving. It was doing so well. It had been 5 years kind of pushing this rock up a hill, and it suddenly felt like the rock was starting to roll down the hill on its own and everybody was having a lovely time. But we were also in the middle of a buyout merger. And so I was tasked with, you know, I had rather insane, you know, numbers over my head and targets to hit, which I did meet year on year. But it was just a lot. I was doing so, so much and working insane hours. But also I think it bleeds more into kind of life generally, right? And the kind of having it all and maintaining a friendship group and working out and having a successful career and making time to go on a date and it was just crazy. Like, it was crazy. I was living in a way that was so deeply unhealthy. I was, you know, getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning and heading into Soho to do my workout class, but I was taking a work call on my way, and I was, you know, I was managing clients internationally, so there was no kind of restrictions on time limits or when anyone could talk to me. And I didn't have any boundaries in place because I loved my job. I just loved it. And I thought that it was going really well and that I was really happy. And I just wasn't listening to my body. And I wasn't aware that I was kind of existing in this adrenaline pumped place where my system was stuck in fight or flight the entire time. And there's only so long that you can live like that before your body gives up. And mine did. It literally did. Like, one day I just couldn't get out of bed. And I couldn't water my plants, and I couldn't even take my dog downstairs to go to the toilet. I had to call my neighbour and be like, something's happening. Can you come and take the dog downstairs to go to the loo? And it scared the shit out of me. I felt like I was in this kind of 90-year-old woman's body. And I didn't feel depressed, you know, like mentally it wasn't a kind of sad that, you know, people said, are you depressed? No, I really wasn't depressed. It was something else, and it changed my life. It changed my life. I had to leave work. I didn't work for half a year. I had to leave Gleam, and I would never go back after that. So it was a crazy time. It was a painful time, for sure.
Could you tell us then about how Bergstrom Studios, your current venture, was kind of born out of that period, and what you aimed to do maybe differently in terms of how you ran your life and your work and the intersection between the two?
So upon leaving Gleam, I mean, they were really great and really supportive when I was ill, and I was incredibly fortunate. You know, I went on paid sick leave for 3 months, and then I went back and said, look, I can't come back. So I'll just take that 3 months as my paid leave, you know, my 3 months leave. What do you call it? Sorry, when you have to work the 3 months.
Severance.
Yeah, you have to work. When you hand your notice in, right, you have to work for a certain amount of months before you can leave. And they said, no, don't be ridiculous. Like, this job has made you ill. Like, you can have another 3 months paid anyway. And we don't expect you to come in. And we just love you to help us hire somebody else. So that was really supportive. And I mean, what a unique position to take half a year off work and be paid. You know, I'm so lucky that I had that. But then it was like, okay, fuck, what am I going to do? Like, I need to pay rent. I need to in money, and I knew I needed to come up with something fast. And I think the thing for me was, I did not want to work for anyone else again. Like, I did not want to line somebody else's pockets. I was so sick of that. I was slightly resentful of that at that time in my career. And I knew whatever I was going to do next, I was going to do it for myself. And Gleam was amazing in the sense that I had an opportunity 5 years into my career, my mid-20s, to set up a literary agency out of nothing. They were like, here's the MacBook, off you go. And I learned that off somebody else's risk and somebody else's time and somebody else's. And I, you know, I learned all the skills and I made the mistakes and I figured it out. And so I felt equipped then to go and do it for myself. And I just knew I could, I just knew I couldn't be like so many people, why don't you get investment? You get investment so easily. And I just didn't want a number over my head. I didn't want a number over my head. I didn't want to have to prove anything or hit a certain level or benchmark. I just wanted to take some of the crumbs that I built for Glean. You know, I would have taken all of my authors if I could, but sadly I couldn't, but I took who I could and go off and do my own thing. And now I work, you know, in three different capacities. The whole ethos and philosophy around Bergstrom Studio is this kind of meeting place, linchpin, this community for writers. And the idea is, we do representation, we work as a traditional literary agency, but we also offer consultancies and do one-to-one direct with aspiring writers, or indeed I work with a lot of really successful published authors on a consultancy basis as well. And this idea of kind of learning from each other and sharing skills, and we've got a Substack attached to it, and I really want to do kind of writing workshops and writing groups and things and build that out in the long term. But also, of course, I'm writing my own books now and I'm developing one into a TV show. So for me, I get to sort of be editor like I was at the beginning of my career and be creative and develop IP and come up, like the ideation is what I thrive on and love. I also get to agent because I'm really fucking good at it and I love that as well. And I've had the honor of working with some of my clients for like well over a decade. And then I get to write and I'm in control and I can do all of those different things. And I don't have to just kind of be one thing.
Well, that's a perfect segue onto your novel or your debut novel, because you've got another one coming out in 2024. What a Shame is the title of the book. Where did the idea come from and how did you fit it in alongside all those other responsibilities?
I think because so much of your job as being an agent, specifically when you're working, as I was at Gleam, with, you know, in that space, like you say, where some projects are ghosted or you're working with people that maybe aren't writers first and foremost, but they have got this following and have captured an audience and people want more from them. And so that's a more heavy-handed way of agenting and developing IP. And so you just, you know, being an agent, being an editor, it's your job to give all your ideas away, you know, and you're constantly collaborating and sharing. And I love working in that way. I still now think that's the way that I work best in terms of creativity. But I was getting to a point where I was just, I needed something for myself. I needed somewhere to put my ideas and to just keep something back for me. And so I just started writing on a Saturday morning. There was no big dream to write a book. There was no, I would literally get up on a Saturday morning for joy, like for joy. I wasn't like setting the alarm and being disciplined at the beginning. I was just being creative and writing, you know, nonfiction, essays, poetry, fiction. It was just fun. And some of those nonfiction pieces then got published, you know, in L and very, you know, Refinery and various other broadsheets or what have you. And I could just see these themes that were coming up around female shame, around kind of female trauma, and these things that were coming up. And I just thought, there's something that you want to say here, and this could be developed into a book. And so then I started kind of consciously knitting and cobbling it together to write a book, which is a really long-winded, terrible way to go about it. Do not recommend that. But that's how it came about for me. And so it took quite a long time. And then, of course, I did get more disciplined on my weekends with writing because I was nearing the end and I wanted to finish it. But that's kind of how it came about.
Just rolling back a little bit to the work you do at the moment at Bergstrom Studio, on the kind of consultancy piece, I mean, how does it work? We've had on the show the head of the Faber Academy and the head of Curtis Brown Creative and these kind of creative writing schools. Is it something analogous to that, or do you regard it as a more kind of industry focused bit? And again, in our spirit of always asking about money, how much does it cost the clients if they're interested in that sort of service?
So it's important for me to create something that's accessible and create something that everybody can afford and that spans across. So, you can start off from anything as kind of being a free subscriber to our Substack or paying as little as £7 a month, where I'm constantly sharing tips and information and like a lot of the stuff that I would share in certain consultancies, all the way up to maybe £2,000, depending on the level of one-to-one, or if you've gone away and written a, you know, 150,000 word manuscript. So our prices really vary, but the point is there's something for everyone, and we can offer something at every price point. It is very similar to the kind of, to what other, you know, Curtis Brown offers in some things, and Faber as well. I suppose a lot of what they do is slightly more group orientated, is my understanding, and course orientated, where this is much more of a one-to-one. So a recent example, we had somebody submit an idea for a proposal for a book that they wanted, and I think they'd sent it out to agents and they hadn't had any luck. So Megan, who works at Bergstrom Studio, my colleague, she did a nonfiction package where she worked on the proposal, developed the idea with the writer, and then they got signed. And now they've got an agent, and, you know, fingers crossed they'll go on to get a publisher and get published. Now, of course, there's no guarantee of that. Sometimes I work with Sunday Times best-selling novelists who come to me and they've, you know, they're on their third novel and they're a bit stuck or they've lost their way, and I'll work on the manuscript and develop it with them at that stage as well. So it's much more personalized, it's much more one-to-one, but it's quite varied. I would only ever take on something that I believe in. I'm not really interested in setting up and taking money from every Tom, Dick and Harry, because the reality is it's really tough to get published. And I think for me, I wouldn't feel comfortable taking somebody's money if I thought, like, I don't think you're ever going to have a shot. So we're incredibly selective about what we take on. We probably don't take on a lot of what we're sent in the way of consultancies. So it's like, that's quite a key difference, I would say, in how we operate.
And sorry again to jump back to your own writing. I was interested to see that once you'd written a manuscript, you submitted it under a pseudonym. Could you explain the sort of rationale behind that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm, you know, publishing's a small world, small business. And, you know, I sell to a lot of these editors that would be receiving, and that puts them in a kind of awkward position. You know, they've got this working relationship with me, but they're like, don't want to publish a novel. It's crap. So I didn't want to get a book deal off the back of my name or being known. Similarly, you know, I'm really friendly and really close with some people. So I didn't want my reputation, good or bad, you know, somebody might have loved the book, but not like me and not going to take it on. I just didn't want who I was to have any say. I wanted to go through that process like so many of the writers that I work with do, completely cold, completely unknown, and the writing has to do the work and the writing has to speak for itself. So it's just really important to me that the book was commissioned purely and solely off the back of writing alone. It had nothing to do with, like, you know, who I was or have been known. And I'm glad, because it's surprising. A lot of people say to me now, like, oh, it must have been easier for you to get your book published because obviously, like, you know lots of people and da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, no, not really. I got an agent under a pseudonym, and then I got a publishing deal under a pseudonym. And I didn't kind of disclose that it was me until I had offers, so.
What was the pseudonym, out of interest?
Oh, it was awful. It was Jessica Sharp. So bad. It's actually quite hard to find a name. If you Google it, there isn't, you know, stuff online. I knew the editor would, or the agent rather, would Google me. So I had to find a name where if you Googled, nothing kind of came up.
So just on the kind of first setting, on the mechanics of that. So you submitted blind to agents, and then you explained to them that you were submitting under a pseudonym, or you just kind of said this is your name, or like, did you, because, you know, how did they, did your agent know who you were?
So I sent it out, I didn't hear back, I got some rejections, I gave up, then COVID happened, and then I kind of reworked on the manuscript again, then I sent it out again under a pseudonym, and my agent Kate emailed me at like 10 o'clock at night. I think I'd submitted it at like 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock or something. She emailed me at 10 o'clock at night to say, look, I'm halfway through this and I'm really loving it, I'd be really interested to have a meeting. And then I got a message from her at 2 o'clock in the morning being like, I finished, I love this, like, when can we meet? And so we spoke on the phone the following day and we talked about the book and blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, you know, I'm curious that you didn't really say a lot about yourself, or like, you know, what do you do? And that was a moment where I was like, oh, I work in publishing. And she was like, ah, right, got it. And she was like, you know, sort of asked who I was. And I told her at that point who I was. And she was fine with it. I mean, she always says I tricked her. Like, no agent wants to agent an agent. And she's always like, you know, it's a nightmare. I never want to agent an agent. But yeah, it wasn't a problem for her. She was fine with it. And she was happy to fulfill my wishes and send the book out on under a pseudonym as well.
How did you find an editor that you wanted to work with, given that you kind of had personal relationships with some of them?
I think a lot of people make the mistake of wanting to have an editor that is anonymous, not a mistake, because of course, really established, really experienced editors are so because they're brilliant and they work with incredible writers. But sometimes in my experience of working in-house, those editors, they haven't got any fire in their belly. They haven't got anything to prove. They've proven themselves, you know, they're more kind of slow-paced movers in a good way. But I think when you're a debut writer and you're a young up-and-coming writer, I think you want that matched in an editor. You want somebody who's got like fire in their belly, that needs to prove themselves, that is hungry, that is ultimately do something brilliant if you want to get a promotion or a pay rise or go somewhere else. And I see a lot of people make decisions on editors based on this kind of, you know, they're a very, very senior publisher, or they've worked with, I don't know, Caroline Duffy in the past or what have you. I get it. But I think you can get a lot more out of someone who's earlier on in their career and hungry and scrappier. And I think I had that in mind. And so my editor, I mean, she's not as junior as I've just made her sound by any stretch of the imagination. But there was something in Lily where I could see she was hungry and scrappy, and kind of that felt like the right fit for that book.
We're coming up towards the end of our time, but I wanted to ask at the end, we have a lot of listeners who are themselves aspirant writers. What would your advice be for people who are looking to get representation at the beginning of their career? And how would you, you know, how would you suggest people go about it?
One tip that I give is always read the acknowledgements in the back of books that you love or are similar to the book or in the genre of the book you want to put out, because authors always thank their agents there. So it's a really quick, streamlined way to find out about, to find those agents who share your tastes. I think, you know, when you contact agents, remember, like, they don't want like your life story. They want to know about the product. Like, pitch the book and position it. What is it about? Why am I interested? It's like you're selling into them too. And I think sometimes, yeah, I often get sort of people's life stories or the kind of, don't share the journey you've had thus far. Like, always submit as if you're submitting for the first time. And keep it short. Keep it snappy. Keep it pithy. And I would usually attach three chapters as opposed to the entire manuscript, because quite often when I get sent submissions, when it's a whole manuscript, I think, oh God, right, I'll do that later, I haven't got time now. Whereas if there's three chapters, I'll just sort of, okay, and sit with my cup of tea, and then before I know it, I've gobbled them up and I'm asking you for the manuscript. So that can be quite a good way to whet their appetite and get them to engage, because there's a lot in their inbox, you know, it can push you to the top.
Is that with fiction or with non-fiction as well? You'd expect to see the whole manuscript?
No, non-fiction, you just expect to see a proposal.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the advice is a very useful note to end on. So thank you, Abigail, for your time and for your candor, and wishing you all the very best with all your projects going forward.
Thank you so much.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Abigail Bergstrom. She's on Twitter at Abigail Bergstrom, so without the O. And her book, What a Shame, is published by Hodder. You can find Bergstrom Studio at www.bergstromstudio.co.uk. Hello, it's us again. Simon, what was your takeaway from the interview with Abigail?
I thought it was very interesting on two grounds. The first being another kind of behind-the-scenes look at the business of literary agenting, which I think I and you both found very interesting, but also hopefully something that our listeners will take away from. But the second being that she spoke with, I thought, a lot of candour and a lot of honesty about her experience of burnout, which is something that I think happens more widely than people want to talk about. And again, I think, you know, it's kind of credible and bold of her to be so open about that. So it was a conversation that I really enjoyed. What about you, Rachel?
Yeah, very much agree on both fronts. We had another war story of someone starting out in publishing and living in a cockroach-infested flat. I was particularly fascinated by her story of submitting her own manuscript under a pseudonym and making sure that she was getting the right person for the job, given her own experience as an agent. So yeah, very multifaceted conversation. What have you been up to, Simon?
I have been having a little bit of time off, which is now coming to an end, and trying to sort things out in my new flat. This process of reconciliation, Rachel, that you have referred to, when one moves in with one's partner and has to work out where all the different things go. So that has been good. And working out the kind of plan for my next steps with my book and my magazine work. And then, in the spirit of talking about our cultural consumption, I have been reading a book by Ella Meyer, who is this Swiss travel writer that I'm writing about in my new book, called Croisière et Caravane, so Cruises and Caravans, which is a kind of memoir of hers, which I'm really enjoying. And then in TV, I have finished watching Ganglands, this very violent French show, and then continuing the sort of French theme, I'm watching the Netflix show about the Tour de France, which I'm actually really, really enjoying and finding very compelling. What about you, Rachel?
That sounds very busy and very fulfilling. At work, I'm reviewing a book about an art thief, which is the sort of thing that I enjoy. And on television, I finished Ted Lasso, which I thought was a bit underwhelming in this season. But I'm also looking ahead to the double release of Barbie and Oppenheimer on July the 21st. And hopefully we'll be writing about that. So, yes.
A cinematic red letter day. Are you going to try and see them? Are you going to try and watch them back to back?
Well, I'll hopefully get to see advanced screenings, but we'll see. Ideally, those will be back to back for full maximum drawing potential. Yeah.
Where do you stand on the pivotal question as to whether Ryan Gosling is too old for the role of Ken?
I think that's ageism. I don't agree. And also his comic timing, judging it by the trailer, seems to be very good. So I think, yeah, that's harsh on poor Ryan.
Excellent. Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Acomb.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jessica Danheiser. And our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Twitter at Take Notes Always, on Instagram at Always Take Notes. If you'd like to support us on our crowdfunding page on Patreon, we're on there under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.